Welcome to episode 10 of the Eastern Standard documentary series Rise. This episode, Mining and Flooding Cause and Effect, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and we begin this hour with the story of a conversation about connections between surface mining and flooding. Here's Special Projects reporter Chris Begley.
Coal and eastern Kentucky are inextricably linked in our minds, in our history, in the present, and as we imagine our future. When we began our series Rise, exploring the aftermath of the floods of July 2022, we heard people asking whether the coal industry, with its huge impact on the landforms and geography of the region, had any role in the flooding. Many of us had not thought about that connection. I suspect a lot of people thought, as I did, that so much rain in so short a time, 12 inches or more in a few hours, would result in devastating flooding no matter what. I had no idea whether or not the way we had altered the landscape also changed the nature of the floods. Did it make it worse? Did changes in the landforms, the vegetation, and the waterways that we saw because of mining, timbering, or natural gas extraction contribute to the devastation in the region? As part of our investigation into this possibility, we talked with Jack Spadaro, a mining engineer based in West Virginia, who investigates these questions and frequently serves as an expert witness in lawsuits dealing with these issues. He's familiar with the scientific data, with the anecdotal data, and has seen how this has played out in the legal arena. My producer, Jean Marie Hibbard, and I drove to West Virginia to ask him these questions.
Is there evidence that directly connects surface mining or mountaintop removal with the recent floods in Appalachia?
Yes. And there's plenty of evidence. There's no question about it. There have been repeated floods since the mid-1990s. Some of them have been fatal. All of the floods in southern West Virginia and eastern Kentucky that I've investigated, we were able to prove without question that mining was a major factor, and often the factor, the only factor in the damage that was caused by the flooding. Mining was a major factor in the eastern Kentucky floods of July 2022, not just a contributing factor, the major factor. In some of the watersheds that I have seen, there were 3,000 to 4,000 acres of, in the headwaters of the watersheds, 3,000 to 4,000, even in some cases as large as 6,000 acres of land that had been disturbed by mining. The trees had been removed. The topsoil had been shoved into the valleys. Valley fills had been constructed by just simply dumping soil and rock into the headwaters of these streams. So when this substantial rainfall hit on July 28th of 2022, there was almost immediate runoff into the watersheds, and that created essentially a tidal wave of not just water, but mine debris that was very destructive and resulted in the deaths of 40 people and millions of dollars worth of damage to homes and businesses throughout eastern Kentucky.
I wondered, how could he be so certain? With these unprecedented rains, how could investigators discern what sort of impact mining and other disturbances might have had?
Mountaintop removal mining can increase the peak discharge in a given watershed during a rainfall period by between 250% up to 1,000%. We've proven that by doing hydrologic analysis where you model the watershed and apply the rainfall that actually occurred to the watershed with conditions that existed prior to mining, and then you compare it to the conditions that existed on the day of the flood. And so we've proven scientifically that there's no question that the mining was, in most instances, the causes of the flood.
Coal mining may be the source of much of the landform disturbances in the area, but it's not the only one. Other extractive industries like timber and natural gas also have major impacts on the topography and the forest cover of the region. Deforestation associated with timbering changed drainage patterns so much in the early 20th century, when the Ohio River nearly ran dry, that Congress passed the Weeks Act in 1911 to protect waterways. What about flooding in areas with little or no coal mining?
One flood event that seems to be significantly different than this is something that happened where part of my family's from, around Clendenin in West Virginia, a few years ago, where there's not mining. And it was very similar in some respects. Heavy rain, a lot of areas that had never been flooded had seen this. Does that suggest that there may be more to this?
I lived in that watershed. I lived in a place called Procius in the early 1970s. That's upstream from Clendenin. And what I know about that watershed is it's been extensively timbered. And there is also, it's probably one of the most heavily drilled areas for oil and gas in West Virginia, and has been since the turn of the 20th century. And the new modern drilling sites for oil and gas operations are massive. And in fact, my very first case as an expert witness was in 1977. Landslide, flooding, property damage caused by Pennzoil in developing a new gas area in Lincoln County, West Virginia. It was in federal district court in April 1977. So my answer to that is still there are different kinds of disturbances in these watersheds that do contribute to flooding, and timbering and oil and gas drilling are also a factor, and were so often a factor in the floods in southern West Virginia, at least. The cases I work on right now involve landslides created by oil and gas drilling sites and access roads. Say, for instance, Richwood, West Virginia was flooded. That's an area that has been timbered extensively since the beginning of the century.
So although the disturbances weren't from surface mining, they were similar in the sense that it was deforesting part of the watershed.
Yes.
Okay. Unreclaimed or abandoned mine lands are the subject of a lot of discussion now, and one of the questions is the way in which they might have contributed in particular to these floods.
Well, I agree that they have, because both the state of West Virginia and Kentucky and Virginia have failed in their duty to ensure that reclamation is concurrent during the mining operations, and have failed to ensure that the mining companies live up to their obligation to reclaim land. Passage of the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act in 1977, the federal government relinquished control of the enforcement to the states, and the states were supposed to be making certain that the federal standards were adhered to. That never happened because the state agencies were a lot weaker and were more susceptible to the influence of the mining industry.
These lawsuits that rely on these hydrologic studies have been successful. You've been able to receive some sort of compensation for the victims.
Yes. Families in both Kentucky and West Virginia have received compensation for the damages that were caused by the runoff from the active surface mines.
With the passage of the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act of 1977, federal regulations mandated that surface mines were reclaimed, returned to approximate original contour of the area, and replanted with different types of trees and grasses. This reclamation might mitigate some of the flooding concerns. I asked Jack about how this process worked, and if it worked.
When a company begins a mining operation, they're required to have reclamation bonds in case they don't meet the standards of the reclamation that they're supposed to do. In cases where you might have damages resulting from improper or incomplete reclamation, what happens when the company declares bankruptcy or if there's insufficient funds in these bonds?
The people pay the price for final reclamation. That is the problem with the system that's been set up. The bonding amounts that are required by the state agencies are not sufficient from the get-go to do reclamation work that might be necessary if the mine goes bankrupt. And there right now are hundreds of millions of dollars of reclamation work that needs to be done to stabilize these areas in areas where the mines have gone bankrupt. So neither the bonding that's available nor any of the resources that are left through the bankruptcy process are enough to do the reclamation work. So we have perhaps as much as 10,000 acres of land in central Appalachia that is lying unreclaimed because the companies have gone bankrupt and the bonding capacity is insufficient and the state agencies and the federal agencies responsible have allowed it to happen and don't seem to be willing to take the initiative to begin the reclamation work that would protect downstream residents from flooding.
The state and federal agencies involved. Do you have an idea why are they unresponsive? Is this something that has to do with budget or personnel, or is it a political issue?
It's clearly a political issue. At least until recently in Kentucky, I didn't see any administrations until the most recent Bashir administration, which does seem to be concerned. But until that time, I didn't find any administrations in Kentucky that were willing to do the enforcement that needs to be done to protect the downstream residents from flooding. In fact, often the mining operators were allowed to go for months, perhaps years, without doing any reclamation work because the state agency enforcement effort was nil. And that was certainly the case in Harless Creek. When the Harless Creek flooded, I flew the watershed in a helicopter and filmed it all. And there was no place in that watershed that had been reclaimed. It was an active mine, and the mining had been allowed to go way beyond the limits, and there was no contemporaneous reclamation whatsoever. Same in Quicksand Creek when we flew the watershed and then went down on the ground and looked at the ground and took photos. The mines that had been nearly completely bond released were not reclaimed. And so the state had failed in ensuring that standards be met to at least reduce the amount of runoff that would occur.
And the standards suggest that because these are enormous mines that may go on for years and years, that there should be some simultaneous reclamation even as the mine continues in other places.
Yes. Yeah.
Coal is central to our vision of Appalachia, and it seems to have shaped so much of the culture and history of the region. But it's only been part of life there as an industry for the last 130 years or so. The railroads came into eastern Kentucky around the turn of the 20th century, and with it, the coal industry. Initially, the mines were underground. After World War II, we started surface mining, and in the late 1970s, we began mountaintop removal. This mechanization of mining resulted in a dramatic drop in the number of people employed in the industry. Today, only a fraction of the former number are employed directly in the coal industry, around 5,000 people, fewer than work at Dollar General stores throughout the Commonwealth. But coal retains an outsized influence.
To what degree has the coal industry shaped Central Appalachia?
The coal industry has been a primary element in the culture and the life of people in Appalachia since probably the 1890s, if not before.
What are some of the things that it shaped?
It shaped the ways that people made a living, for one, but also it shaped the communities that grew up around the mining complexes. For instance, my hometown of Mount Hope, West Virginia, was the headquarters for a mining company that controlled most of the high-grade metallurgical coal in southern West Virginia at that time, at the turn of the century, all the way up until the 1960s. And so there were dozens of mining communities around the hub, which was my hometown of Mount Hope. And those communities were, by and large, communities of mine workers and their families who came from all parts of Eastern and Southern Europe and Great Britain. And so they were quite diverse communities, actually. The communities were strong in my town because of the ethnic mix there. And then the integration that occurred in the mid-1950s, a rich, tolerant community. For the time, it was very tolerant because of the mines and the fact that the coal miners worked together in the mines, and there were people from Hungary and Poland and Czechoslovakia and Ukraine and Sicily, where my grandfather came from, and even Spain. There were Spanish miners and their families. So that made, for me anyhow, in my experience, a very rich and abundant education. Because when we integrated, a good half of my teachers were black teachers who taught at the high school in the town, the Du Bois High School, before we integrated.
Talk about the legacy of the coal industry in Appalachia. And some of the elements of that legacy have been talked about a lot, some of the environmental elements and stuff. And I wonder if you might talk about both the positive and negative elements of that legacy.
Positive elements was, again, going to the integration of the workplace, miners, regardless of their ethnic background or their color, were pretty much equal. They got equal pay for equal work. So the communities were, to a large degree, almost classless. So there was a strong economy in these communities. And at least, again, in my experience, there were lots of educators because they were associated with the mining company, were actually brought into the mining community. So I got a pretty rich education. And I think that in many ways, the mining companies did enhance the possibilities for people to be educated and move on beyond the mining itself. The adverse results were miners who have lung disease, miners who were injured in horrible mining accidents, miners who were killed, and the fact that the families, by and large, were not given much in the way of any kind of compensation if they lost someone in a mining accident. And so that, over time, the results to me, at least in, again, my experience and what I've seen, has been negative in regards to the health of not only the miners themselves, but their families.
And then, of course, there's also the environmental issues, which impact health issues and every other aspect of it.
Right. In northern West Virginia, one of my first jobs was studying acid mine drainage. So I traveled throughout northern West Virginia, and a good probably 50% of the streams in northern West Virginia were contaminated with acid mine drainage. A portion of the streams in southern West Virginia also, but not nearly as large a percentage because the quality of the coal in southern West Virginia was higher and there was less sulfur in the coal. So the streams and the groundwater were contaminated. And then the coal processing plants pumped billions of gallons of contaminated water either directly into streams or into leaking containment ponds or into the groundwater system itself. And I participated in one lawsuit where about 750 people had their wells contaminated with mine wastewater, and there were horrible effects on those people. Neurological damage, cancers, kidney troubles, and so forth.
The history and the legacy of coal is complex and sometimes contradictory. We may be proud of our history or feel a nostalgia for the life in the coal fields that we remember from childhood. At this moment, some of us are wondering if that legacy contributed to the impacts we suffered from the 2022 floods. What should people do if they think they were affected by mining, timber, or oil and gas activities?
If somebody thinks that they've been affected in this way, what's the process that they would go through in terms of contacting an agency or an engineer or a lawyer to help them through whatever's next?
In Kentucky, the landowner alone can file a citizen's complaint under the state provision of the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act, and the state is required to conduct an investigation. The state agency under the environmental cabinet in Kentucky is responsible for it. In Kentucky and West Virginia, it's the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection. It's a legal procedure that was built into the Surface Mining Act to allow citizens to file a complaint and see if they can get any kind of resolution of a problem. And as far as I know, in Kentucky in July of 2022, there were hundreds of citizen complaints to the state agency, and therefore the federal agency, that mining was a major factor in the flooding. The citizens, in many of these instances, have banded together and brought lawsuits because even after filing a citizen's complaint with the state and sometimes federal agency, nothing was done. The agencies, particularly in Kentucky and West Virginia, the state agencies are not responsive to citizen complaints and do not take any decisive action to correct the conditions.
Is there a workaround to that? Can you go directly to the federal agencies?
Yes, there is a procedure. If a citizen's not satisfied with the state response, they can file a complaint with the Federal Office of Surface Mining Reclamation and Enforcement. And again, I'm sorry to say that that agency has been even less responsive than the state agencies.
When I'm imagining all of this play out, this takes months, years perhaps, for these lawsuits to be resolved. Do you have data on how long these typically take?
Yes. I worked for the federal government until 2004. As I said, part of the years I worked were involved in abandoned mine lands. But when I left the federal government in 2004, I began doing work as an expert witness in mine safety cases, in cases involving flooding, landslides, and so forth. And the first case I worked on, I think in 2005, was a lawsuit that had been brought on behalf of several thousand people in West Virginia who had been flooded in July of 2001. That case did not go to trial until March of 2006. It was eventually successful, and people whose property had been damaged by the flooding did receive compensation for their damages. In others, I have a case right now that was begun, I think, in 2003, and that case has not gone to trial yet. So that's part of the problem with the lawsuits, is it takes so long through this court system for people to get any kind of resolution. And by that time, if they've lost their homes or their property's been severely damaged, they're pretty much at a loss.
So in Appalachia, we have 150 years of coal mining, 75 years of surface mining, well over 100 years of timbering. Can these watersheds recover? Are there examples of places that have undergone these sorts of disturbances, the kind that could produce the flooding, that have managed to get beyond that?
I don't know that any have managed to get beyond continuing to have damage, but it is possible for a watershed to be restored. And I know that from the work that I did for about 16 years with the Federal Office of Surface Mining. And before that, when I worked for the state of West Virginia, with the right resources and with the knowledge that's needed to get the drainage controlled in a given watershed and to get a diverse and effective permanent vegetative cover, one can restore a watershed. I've seen it done.
So all of these things that result from these disturbances, the increased runoff, the increased flood risk, the landslides, none of that is inevitable.
No, and my quarrel all along since I began doing this work back in the 1960s is if these mining companies and these oil and gas companies and these timbering companies would simply adhere to the standards that have been established by law or by consensus within the industry, we would not have these kinds of floods. The problem has been flagrant abuse of the standards and the failure by the federal and state governments charged with protecting the public, the failure by those agencies to simply do their job. And the failure by the mining company, when they agree and take a permit, they agree to comply with all standards. And it's spelled out in the body of the permit and the design of the sediment control structures, the diversion channels, the reclamation plan. They agree to do that, but I have seldom seen it done.
Can the watershed recover? Can the mountains recover? Can the forest recover? The big question is, can Eastern Kentucky recover?
Reporter Chris Begley with mining engineer Jack Spadaro. Spadaro's conclusions are echoed in an analysis for a court case concerning the flood of July 22 by Scott Simonton, a registered professional engineer with over 30 years of experience. Numerous studies have shown, writes Simonton, that surface mining in general and improper design, construction, and maintenance of runoff and sediment control structures in particular will lead to increased flooding and flood damage downstream of these operations. State mining regulators in the Energy and Environment Cabinet declined our request for an interview and an opportunity to address the issues raised by Spadaro, as well as others you'll hear from later in the hour. But we do have questions about the timeliness of mine reclamation and about the adequacy of the Kentucky Reclamation Guarantee Fund, established as a backstop for when mine company bonds fall short of the cost of reclaiming mine sites.
This strip mining, I think, lays at the forefront of this because when they strip mine, they disturb the soil and they don't leave anything up on the mountain to hold the water back.
Reverend Stephen Peake, pastor at Corinth Baptist Church in Fleming Neon, a Letcher County community that was hit hard in the 2022 flood. He raises the concern we're exploring in this hour, do surface mines make flooding worse? And as public health doctor and epidemiologist Beverly May asks,
was the Surface Mine Control and Reclamation Act implemented to carry out its purpose of protecting human life? And if it wasn't, then what do we need to do to protect people from the next major rain event and the next flood that's surely coming?
Reverend Peake and Dr. May were speaking at a press conference held last winter by Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, calling on the Departments of the Interior and Justice in Washington to investigate and establish whether there is a relationship between surface coal mining and the severity of floods. It's been almost a year since that letter was sent, and there's been no response. But requests for a federal investigation by two other agencies have been granted. We'll have more on that later in the hour. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Episode 10 of Rise, an Eastern Standard documentary series on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Berea College. With a commitment to serving Appalachian students, Berea has not charged tuition since 1892. All students participate in a paid work program, providing professional experience as well as an inclusive, supportive education. Details at berea.edu.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events from Kentucky Humanities. On Thursday, February 8th, the Marion County Public Library in Lebanon will host Kentucky Chautauqua, Daniel Boone, the first Kentuckian. The performance will begin at 5 p.m. On Saturday, February 10th, the Thomas Hunt Morgan House in Lexington will host Kentucky Chautauqua, William Wells Brown, How I Got My Name. The show will begin at 1 p.m. And on Saturday, February 17th, the Woodford County Public Library in Versailles will host Kentucky Chautauqua, Colonel Charles Young, Bridge Builder. The performance will begin at 2 p.m. For more information on programs and coming events, visit kyhumanities.org. This is Sherry Lawson, now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
It's the Eastern Standard documentary series Rise on WEKU. Our focus in this episode, mining and flooding, cause and effect. A central question now being raised in the aftermath of the July 2022 flooding in eastern Kentucky is whether the law that was created to protect people and the environment from the effects of surface mining has been respected by mining interests and enforced by federal and state regulators. Beverly May, the public health doctor and epidemiologist, lives along Wilson Creek in Floyd County.
The Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act of 1977 was passed by Congress in part in response to the Buffalo Creek flood, which killed 125 people in 1972. And the most central purpose of that law is to protect human life. It's also to protect the environment, but we forget that surface mining can be dangerous for humans.
When surface mines destroy forests to get at the coal buried beneath trees, underbrush, and topsoil, there are consequences. Rebecca Shelton, policy director at the Appalachian Citizens Law Center.
It's been fairly well established that water runs off of these mine sites more readily than it does off of a forested mountain. There's just less capacity for the sites to absorb water when they're devoid of topsoil and or natural vegetation.
Erin Savage, Senior Program Manager at Appalachian Voices.
If we can get surface mines reclaimed in eastern Kentucky and southwest Virginia, those mines, once reforested, will really help mitigate future flood impacts.
Earlier, mining engineer Jack Spadaro told us that over the years of supervising mine inspections, he has connected severe flooding of communities to the nearby presence of surface mines. In light of the July 2022 flood, there is gathering interest in taking a closer look at this connection. They've been digging into it at the Appalachian Citizens Law Center in Whitesburg. Mary Cromer is deputy director there and a co-author of a report released in late January that reflects questions being raised by survivors of July 22 who are now focusing on what's contributing to these floods. Thanks for joining us, Mary.
Thank you, Tom.
Now, as I understand it, a Kentucky surface coal mine can have one of these A1 or active designations when the permit is not expired and there are coal reserves in the ground. Even if mining's been on hold for a while, if the permit holder files bankruptcy and abandons a mine, the Department of Natural Resources in Frankfort can then yank the permit, demand bond forfeiture, and try to get the courts to enforce reclamation work that might reduce the runoff that drives these floods. But you and Rebecca Shelton there at the Appalachian Citizens Law Center have looked at the trends and come away with some concerns about the pace of reclaiming these lands. And you raise them in a report on functionally abandoned active surface mines. So are you concerned that these mines are not being reclaimed as they're supposed to be?
We're concerned that these idle sites have not been contemporaneously reclaimed as the law requires. There are kind of two main phases of a mining operation. There's the active phase when coal is being removed, and then there's the reclamation only phase. And the law has very particular requirements that during the active phase, this contemporaneous reclamation must be done. And so we're concerned for these active permits that this contemporaneous reclamation hasn't been kept up. Because the permits have to be maintained, it requires equipment, it requires personnel. The longer they remain idle, the greater likelihood there is that they're going to just continue to degrade and continue to present these hazards of water pollution and slides. We also have a concern about once they are formally determined to be in the reclamation only phase, then we get into the bond release issues, and we have some concerns, and we're starting to look at how long those processes are taking. But, you know, primarily for this report, we were just looking at those mines that the state has classified as active but are just idle.
Okay. And the law you're referring to is the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act, known as SMCRA. Is that correct?
Correct.
The Energy and Environment Cabinet says mine permits come up for renewal every 5 years. Can these mines be renewed multiple times indefinitely? Is that going on?
Yes. Some of the mines we looked at have been under permit for decades. And so in the process, there are some timelines within SMCRA, but as far as the timelines for reclamation, the law sets minimum times. The company has to keep a mine under permit after the mining has been complete and it's in reclamation only. It has to be kept under permit for certain periods of time to ensure that the land remains stable and revegetation is successful. But there are no maximum time limits. And so if the company chooses to do so, there's really nothing that we have been able to find in the law that would trigger an enforcement that would require the company to just go ahead and get rid of the, you know, release the permit, so long as they are properly maintaining and are not violating any of SMCRA's performance standards. That's a big caveat there. We do have concerns about the enforcement and some violations that may be occurring on these sites.
Was the idea, the driver behind SMCRA, the law, the assumption that by releasing companies of their bond liabilities, that they would then be motivated to move through the reclamation process quickly? And is that working?
That is the assumption. That is how the law was designed. However, if you have a bond amount that is insufficient, and that means that if the cost of reclamation is actually more than the bond that the company has provided for that permit, then there's no real incentive to reclaim. It's cheaper for the permittee to keep the permit under bond than it is to spend the money to do the reclamation.
What are you asking the Department of Natural Resources to do?
Well, for these active permits, we are asking that they be determined to be idled, inactive, and they need to be moved to the reclamation phase. And the state needs to come in and do everything it can within its powers to enforce the law to ensure that the company is moving through those phases of reclamation.
Well, I mentioned much earlier that there is a softening market out there for coal mined in eastern Kentucky. Do you see the day when these coal reserves that are sitting in the ground in these idle mines might make it to the market?
Well, one of the assumptions we used in our report and the reason that we used January 1st, 2021 as our start date is that if these sites were not reactivated when coal prices reached record highs in 2022, they never will be. And so the cabinet says that these mines remain in A1 status because there is coal on them that could be removed. But the cabinet has no way of determining the likelihood that that would ever happen. They only know that there is coal that could be mined under the terms of the current permit that has not yet been mined. So we believe that, you know, if that didn't happen in 2022, it's not going to happen. And so these permits need to be moved into reclamation.
Mary Cromer, Deputy Director of the Appalachian Citizens Law Center in Whitesburg. Thank you so much, Mary.
Thank you.
The Appalachian Citizens Law Center shared their findings with 8 Democratic members of Congress, including Kentucky's Morgan McGarvey. And as a result, the Government Accountability Office, or GAO, which conducts nonpartisan investigations for Congress, has agreed to conduct the study beginning in March. The Law Center's Rebecca Shelton.
They're able to take it a couple steps further. First, for the mines that they identify that are in this kind of limbo They are going to look at the adequacy of bonding and financial assurances for reclamation at those sites, which will be a really important piece of understanding the issue and how to craft solutions. And they'll also produce policy recommendations for SMACRA relative to their findings, identifying whether and how SMACRA, the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act, the regulations therein are or are not effective in ensuring that mine operators are reclaiming mines in a timely manner.
In addition to the GAO study, officials with the Office of Surface Mining Reclamation and Enforcement say they're in the process of conducting a regional investigation regarding whether surface mining potentially exacerbated the flooding issues observed in July of 2022. So this means two studies into the question of cause and effect are now underway or beginning soon. We'll look forward to those findings. Our focus has been on the threat of the runoff from mountaintop removal sites to lives and property in communities below and downstream. But there are additional impacts to the economics and quality of life. The prospect of building a tourism industry in the mountains has been a dream, especially as the region struggles to transition from a coal-based economy and a way of life. Harlan County Judge Executive Dan Mosley has seen the good, the bad, and the troublesome.
There's been some responsible reclamation that has occurred, and I really appreciate the efforts of companies that have been responsible in that. There's a couple of companies, frankly, here that do a fabulous job at reclaiming these mine sites that make beautiful, developable areas. But there have been some bad actors, and there's no hiding that. And there's a couple of folks that have not done it well, and there's one area that has cost our county a lot of money because they didn't reclaim it, and we've had to replace 15 to 20 large tiles over the last few years every time we have a heavy rain event, a flash flood event, because there wasn't proper reclamation done above the site where this was at. So, I mean, we have seen bad actors in that, and then Black Mountain, for instance, that's an area that's restricted from mining and an area that's the highest point of the state. And we're working to develop a true high point experience up there to where people can, we're going to build a observation tower to where people can get up there and see over into Virginia and see down the valley in Kentucky and just have a true high point experience from a tourism component. And I think that'll help bring us some people here. But thankfully, I heard that they're going to be doing some reclamation on a mine site over in Virginia that you can see from the high point on Black Mountain, that mess that was left behind. And I think it's finally moving forward to get that reclaimed. So obviously we want to see that reclaimed because nobody wants to see a big hole in the top of a mountain that you're looking down on. So we're excited to see that happen because we know we're going to have a lot of people come and visit Black Mountain more than ever have when we get this observation tower constructed.
That's Harlan County Judge Executive Dan Mosley. There are other future possibilities for these acres upon acres of abandoned coal mines in eastern Kentucky. If all goes as promised, construction begins in 2026 on a solar power installation on Starfire Mine in Perry, Knott, and Breathitt counties. It was once one of the largest mountaintop removal sites in the entire country. The solar power project is a partnership between Brightnight, a West Palm Beach, Florida renewable energy company, Rivian Automotive, and the Nature Conservancy. They say the site will power over 500,000 households per year. David Femister, State Director of the Nature Conservancy.
If we're losing thousands of acres of prime farmland, if we're having to cut down existing forests or damage existing natural areas to put in solar, you know, those are some real trade-offs that we'd obviously rather not have to make. And so when we can develop renewable energy on brownfields, old industrial sites, or formerly active mine areas, that's a huge advantage from the siting and conservation perspective.
Is there some irony in converting such a vast mountaintop removal coal mine to a renewable energy site?
I guess you could use the term irony, but I think in some ways that's setting it up to be more oppositional than it needs to be. You don't have to be anti-coal to be pro-solar. I think you just have to recognize that the right energy for our country 100 years ago, 50 years ago, 20 years ago is not the right energy for it now and into the future. So this is a really good transition, and I think it can honor the legacy that energy has played in Eastern Kentucky and honor in a way that's continuing that legacy just in a different way.
People who live in the coalfields region have been reluctant to talk about what they've seen and experienced as the Eastern Kentucky coal industry has declined and the area has suffered from severe flooding. But as reporter Chris Begley heard from Elaine Tanner, who lives in the Letcher County community of Dean and heads Friends for Environmental Justice, the most recent flooding was an eye-opener for her neighbors.
It opened their eyes to maybe not hold that allegiance to coal that they've always held on to so tightly before. Coal's not coming back. We know that. And it'll never be like it is. They're mining a little bit of coal here and here and getting these pockets. And, you know, they have a plan. I think, you know, it's in another direction at this point. But we need to come up with a new plan.
From what you've seen, do you think that allegiance to coal is changing?
Somewhat. I think they're hanging on to the memories of coal more than the coal itself. You know, they made their money, and if you understand how, you know, Consol came into Kentucky and they were unionized in West Virginia and they came over here and the people were making $50 an hour not to unionize, basically. So now all these people are sitting back and don't have anything to lean back on. So maybe that allegiance has been somewhat wilted.
Are you hopeful for resolving some of these issues, or that this or anything else is going to create significant change?
I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that the people that have suffered wake up and stand beside me. When we first started organizing down here, these people had no idea. You know, they knew that I filed Safe Drinking Water Act, and, you know, but now that I've been here, they're starting to realize that, you know, I've been doing this a while, and the things that I say have come to truth. We have to stand together to be able to find that hope. And that's one of the reasons, not just the mountain that I love so much, but the people that are here. We will make these changes together. We will come through this and we will grow.
When you spend a lot of time, as Chris Begley has with this assignment, researching a story, talking to people, giving what you've heard, seen, and read a lot of thought, you come away with some observations.
While we were reporting for this episode of Rise, we spoke with several people who did not want to talk about the relationship between coal and flooding, even if they thought there was one. This wasn't because they were afraid of the coal companies or deluded into thinking coal was coming back, but rather that they were concerned about their neighbors. They did not want to disparage an industry that their friends and family may have worked in for years. And they sure didn't want to suggest that any of these people were somehow responsible for the death and destruction brought by the floods. I think that reluctance to talk has been misinterpreted by some as an attempt to defend the coal industry, when in fact it seems to have much more to do with maintaining relations with your neighbors, friends, and family. Those sentiments seem admirable enough, but it's easy to see the problem that can arise from not talking about something that you might ought to talk about. Uncomfortable conversations sometimes have to happen. But all of this points to another phenomenon, and that's the conflation of everything related to the coal industry into one thing, coal with a capital C. The license plate says Friends of Coal. You can't get one that says Friends of the Coal Miner or Friends of the Coal Operator or Friends of the Coal Company. But these used to be very distinct things, often on opposite sides of an issue.
Nobody at Brookside in Harlan County in 1973 would have lumped coal miners and coal operators into a single category. Nobody in Harlan County in the 1930s would have either. You didn't support coal. You either supported coal miners or coal companies. Through advertising, PR campaigns, and surely related to the decline of unions, it's become black and white. You support coal or you don't. In her song, Florence Reese asked, "Which side are you on?" It no longer means which side of the picket line, but which side of the war on coal. I understand the urge to protect your neighbors, and that strikes me as a good thing. Avoiding the uncomfortable conversations, however, seems unwise. And these conversations might be a lot less uncomfortable if we can remember that it's not black and white. It's a lot more complicated than that, and we shouldn't be persuaded that it's not. We'll see a lot better in color.
Special Projects reporter Chris Begley.
Well, he's coming off the mountain, 20-ton in tow. Riders break till the windows shake, and every man hears it high and low. Let it slide down the ditch and cry, this old hill's about to roll. Come away with more than a scratch or two. Strip job blues. Strip job blues.
We love the mountains. That's why we're still living here.
Reverend Stephen Peek, the Baptist pastor in Fleming Neon.
We'd like to see things rectified so that we can continue living and not under the threat of it going to have another flood.
Thanks for joining us. The Eastern Standard documentary series Rise is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. G. Marie Hibbert, senior producer, Chris Begley, special projects reporter, Crystal Jones, reporter, Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. And thanks to Ian Noe for the song Strip Job Blues. We're online at weku-rise.org, where you can check out the Rise series archive and sign up for an occasional e-newsletter. You can find this episode of Rise on the station site, weku.org, on the WEKU app, and anywhere you get podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to this latest episode of the Eastern Standard documentary series Rise on WEKU.
Living out blue, strip job blue.